Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media.
Welcome to Earth Eats, a show of real food and green living. I'm Annie Corrigan.
It is one of the very few of these types of books that has a personal note. And he has two or three pages in here that he talks about being born a slave and having to help out the family after emancipation.
Vivian Halloran talking about the book Good Things to Eat, as suggested by Rufus. We go on a tour of old food books with her today. The U.S. is the world's largest soybean exporter. China is the largest buyer. If the Chinese market collapsed, how would that affect American farmers' bottom lines? From Harvest Public Media, will providing financial incentives encourage farmers to incorporate conservation practices into their work? And our ingredient of choice today is beets. Daniel Orr has two recipes for us that highlight this root veggie's underlying sweetness. Starting off our headlines with Mark Chilla today, with how the Trans-Pacific Partnership could impact farmers.
The trade deal among 12 Pacific Rim nations was reached this week, and it could mean more exports from the Midwest. As Harvest Public Media reports, the agreement could be worth billions for U.S. farmers.
The TPP is expected to give U.S. farmers easier access to markets in countries like Japan and Australia by reducing tariffs on products like beef and rice. The details of the agreement haven't been released yet, but David Salmonson of the American Farm Bureau says he's most eager to see what was worked out for U.S. dairy, one of the more contentious commodities debated during negotiations.
Here you had multiple countries, the U.S., Canada, New Zealand, Japan, and Australia, all looking to either get access or defend against granting too much access, dealing with dairy products.
Even with restrictions in place, countries covered under the trade deal already import more than $60 billion of U.S. farm products. Christopher Husted, Harvest Public Media.
The October 3rd deadline for European Union member nations to opt out of GMOs has come and gone, with 19 nations saying no to cultivation within their borders. But the minority of EU member states that have not opted out are embracing genetically modified crops. Nations including Romania, Portugal, and Spain are optimistic about the future of genetically modified crops within their borders. Europe also remains a major buyer of genetically modified grain. Monsanto's genetically modified maize is the only GMO crop approved for cultivation in Europe. It has been grown in Portugal and Spain for years. Rivals are squaring off over a ballot initiative in Massachusetts that would ban the sale of eggs and meat from hens, breeding pigs, and veal calves raised in close confinement. The cage-free measure is slated to come up for a vote in November of 2016. It would affect farms in Massachusetts and states where eggs and meat are produced for the Massachusetts market. The egg industry fiercely opposed a similar measure that passed in California in 2008. The vanguard of the industry side, the United Egg Producers, or UEP, told the Boston Globe that a coalition of groups plans to commission polls and an economic impact study. The fight in Massachusetts comes as McDonald's pushes for cage-free egg suppliers. The company, which uses about 4% of all eggs produced in the U.S., announced in September that it would phase out the use of eggs from hens housed in cages over the next decade. And Whole Foods Market has decided to stop selling products from a prison labor program after reform advocates demonstrated outside of a store in Texas. The company sells two products made with prison labor: goat cheese from Haystack Mountain Dairy and tilapia from Quixotic Farming. Both are made through an arrangement with Colorado Correctional Industries, or CCI, which employs prisoners to milk goats and raise fish. CCI is tied to the state's prison system and says the program helps inmates gain workforce skills they can use after release. The company's director told Fortune that base pay starts at 60 cents per day, but prisoners can earn up to $400 a month with incentives. The company reported in 2014 that it employed more than 1,800 inmates and aims to expand by twice that number over the next decade. Whole Foods plans to remove the two products from its stores by April of next year. You can share these articles on Twitter and Facebook. They're collected at eartheats.org.
Mark Chilla, great work.
Thanks. See you next week.
The economic slowdown in China has spread financial pain around the world, especially among people who sell products there. That includes Midwestern soybean farmers who typically export about a quarter of their crop to China. For Harvest Public Media, Frank Morris reports.
Tall stands of corn and green soybean fields stretch for miles in the river bottomland around Langdon, Missouri. It's up in the northwest tip of the state, a long, long way from Beijing geographically and culturally, but economically, it's right next door.
I think about China all the time. China's the big player in the market.
Farmer Richard Oswald is talking about the market for the corn, and especially the soybeans he raises around here. Six generations of his family have scratched out a living from this land, but news of the economic slowdown in China scared him.
Worried for my living. Yeah, worried for my farm.
Because Chinese exports have helped Oswald's farm prosper.
There's the combine.
It's a brand new red one, a Case IH, the kind of thing that lists for about 300 grand.
To buy a combine, a farmer's got to have a certain price for his crop. He's got to have certain production and a certain price.
For years, farmers like Oswald enjoyed high soybean prices, $12, $13, $14 a bushel. Now they've fallen below $9 a bushel. And Chad Hart, an ag economist at Iowa State University, says it's China.
I've watched soybean prices drop almost $2 over the past couple of months due to rumblings, you know, that China's slowing down and, the devaluation of their currency.
Which makes U.S. exports much more expensive. There's a lot of money at stake here. American farmers are the world's largest soybean exporters, and China is by far the biggest buyer. China buys other stuff from U.S. farmers too, wheat, corn, milo, cotton. But the value of soybean exports, about $14 billion last year, dwarf all the others combined. If that market collapsed, it would trigger a huge global decline in soy prices. But Jay O'Neill, an economist at the International Grains Program at Kansas State University, says he doesn't think soybean exports are all that threatened by the Chinese downturn.
It scares me more regarding my 401k retirement program than it does about agricultural exports.
Bedrock reason for this is pretty simple. China doesn't grow enough food to feed its huge and ever-growing population.
Number one concern in China is food security. So regardless of the strength or weakness of their currency, the Chinese government, first and foremost, will do everything possible to maintain food security.
Now, O'Neill says China does manipulate the market to protect domestic farmers, obstructing U.S. corn and cotton exports, for instance. But O'Neill says that soybeans, which Chinese meat producers need to feed their livestock, are another matter.
Things are always in a state of change when you're talking about China. There are very, very few constants so far, other than the fact that they keep importing very good volumes of soybeans.
And that fact was on parade recently in Des Moines, where U.S. and Chinese grain dealers obliged with polite applause as they inked deal after deal for a total of $5.3 billion worth of soybeans, about the equivalent of an entire year's crop from Iowa or Illinois, the top soybean-producing states. Chen Ying, the deputy director of the Chinese trade group, said it was a one-day record.
Now, let's applause for this remarkable achievement. Thank you.
Well, Ms. Chen, thank you for that wonderful news.
Economist Chad Hart says the deal-signing ceremony wasn't so much news as stagecraft.
It's more a political play or a PR play than a gigantic sale itself.
Hart says the more serious problem with the Chinese slowdown may take a while to hit. 20 years ago, U.S. farmers hardly sold any soybeans to China. Chinese consumers have since gotten steadily and dramatically richer. They could afford pork and poultry. And those Chinese pigs and chickens must first eat a lot of soy meal, creating a huge and lucrative market.
We've gotten used to this trend of steady growth coming out of China. If that's going to start slowing down, that means demand slowing down.
Back on the farm, that's exactly what's bugging Richard Oswald.
As we become more integrated with other nations, we tie our fate to their fate.
Which is why Corn Belt farmers are watching China so closely these days. For Harvest Public Media, I'm Frank Morris.
Later on today, incentivizing farmers to include more conservation practices in their work. Another story from the reporters at Harvest. Vivian Halloran loves to eat. She's right up front about that. Her research took a turn toward food when she discovered a book about slave food in Barbados. She's from Puerto Rico, so she says it was an interesting supplement to her own food life in the Caribbean. Then she became interested in American food traditions. We visited her last year around this time at an exhibition she curated at the Lilly Library called Book Bites, Texts That Influenced and Reflected How America Eats. Part of what she wanted to combat is the notion that there is no such thing as American cuisine.
And so I wanted to dig in deep and see what the origins of where do people start claiming Americanness along with specific food ways. And so I did some research and came up with the first cookbook published in the United States, which is this tiny little one.
It's tiny. It looks like it could be a little hymnal in a church from 1796. Is that right?
Yeah. This was primarily an adaptation of cookery books that had British recipes, but it's the first effort to really incorporate local ingredients, like corn figures prominently. And corn had been embraced out of necessity because the British really preferred wheat. But wheat wasn't inherently easy to grow in this new terrain. So a lot of dishes incorporating locally grown food crops like corn and then meats like turkey were gradually what distinguished America, the emerging American cuisine during colonial times and the early foundational period from the British and European food waste that people have brought with them.
Do we still make some of these recipes maybe with some changes?
Yes. Just meat and potato type of meals are still there, and soups and cakes, obviously. But there's also things we thankfully don't make.
Oyster ketchup.
Ugh. We don't tend to think of ketchups as being anything other than tomato-based, but there are a lot of ketchups, and that's just a general category of mushed up, you know, there's walnut ketchups, there's clearly oyster ones.
Well, let's see here. It's quite a domestic sauce and very good. Serve it up under lamb, veal, or sweetbreads.
If you're eating sweetbreads, I think anything's on the table. I mean, so then the American taste for sweets shown in
1918
book.
Wartime breads and cakes.
Yeah, that kind of recaps the war effort and how American cooks were urged to display their gastronomic citizenship, right? Their patriotism through the way in which they used the few materials they were allowed to cook with, and to nonetheless infuse the sense of the domestic with an idea of normalcy through the serving of desserts.
Looking in that same window at the exhibition is a food book for kids, Young America's Cookbook, which features a striking color image on the cover.
And I chose it because most of the illustrations for cookbooks at this time were not in color and were not photographs. And what I love about it is that it does not promote the stereotypes of just young girls need to cook. There's a young man in a tie who is cooking some sort of meat, and then there's a younger boy who is looking appealingly at the cakes his sister wearing this apron is doling out and letting cool. Also, this whole notion of children being invited to the kitchen and teaching children to cook as part of their education, their civic duty, and also their place in the family.
This one, Good Things to Eat, as suggested by Rufus.
Rufus Estes was one of the first people to acknowledge his background as a slave. He was born as a slave, and then he made his living. He became a professional cook in the railway. So he would cook for presidents. He would cook for very important luminaries. And the receipts, because that's what we used to call recipes, are all very practical, and they're aimed towards people who want to break into food service as a career. And so I like the fact that it's his knowledge. I love his image, and I wanted to proudly display the fact that he self-published this, and it became very popular because he had a very well-established reputation as a good cook of fine food.
When did this come out? Can we see 1911?
Yes. This is before the First World War, and while the railroads were the primary means of luxury travel from the north to the south and across. It's a way in which African Americans could get out physically out of the South, but also make and acquire skills and be independent contractors and have their skills be the source of their good reputation. They were not beholden to anybody but the company, and the company took great pride in promoting Rufus.
As suggested by Rufus is the subtitle of this book. Was this guy known by his first name?
at the time?
Yes, and there's some issue as to, I mean, the fact that he was able to self-finance this and it got distributed and has not been forgotten in the history books. My path to finding him was not very difficult at all. I have at home a paperback edition, like a Dover edition of Rufus's Good Things to Eat. So that attests to how well he was known and how popular the book became. Because again, there are just concise lists of ingredients and specific techniques. So this was how you became educated to work in these kinds of professional cooking scenarios. Also, though, it is one of the very few of these types of books that has a personal note. And he has two or three pages in here that he talks about being born a slave and having to help out the family after emancipation.
Did he talk about what his food life was like when he was a slave?
He did not have a very varied diet. So what he skips over is how he became so well acquainted with fine food. I suspect that he worked in the kitchens of the well-to-do families in the neighborhood. But I wanted to highlight the fact that culinary expertise was not limited to white people with money, and it wasn't limited to women.
Vivian Halloran is an associate professor of comparative literature at Indiana University. It's a day of beets in the kitchen with Chef Daniel Orr. I am pretty excited about it. A quick recipe now, one of my absolute favorites from our archives. This vinaigrette can be spotted on many a Daniel Orr plate. He uses it like an artist uses paint, and it is delicious. Check it out.
I've got my beets ready right here. Again, very tender. When I stick the knife into it, it releases. It feels very, very soft. We're just going to peel them. The way we're going to accentuate the flavors of this beet is with some orange, some honey, and some ginger, some of my favorite flavors, and it really kind of rounds off that, what some people call dirty flavor that beets have, and makes them a little more universally loved, should we say. All right, going to just put the blender on. Now you see, it has a nice thick viscosity to it, coats the spoon, that's what you're looking for.
Love it.
Yeah, and this is also great with goat cheese. Put a little bit of this sprinkled on top, drizzled on top, and have a wonderful dressing. You can use it for all kinds of things.
Find this at eartheats.org. Daniel goes more in depth with the root veggie in the second half today. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Cardinal Spirits, a distillery making handcrafted spirits from regional ingredients in Bloomington, Indiana. More at cardinalspirits.com. And Charles Schwab and Company Incorporated, now with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. I'm Annie Corrigan. Hello. You're connected to Earth Eats. I love beets. They are my favorite of all the vegetables. So this is, maybe it's for me. Did you do this just for me?
Well, I think you put it on the list of things you wanted to do. So I don't know if you did it just for you or you did it for your listeners.
Busted.
We're going to do it anyhow.
I'll admit it. I bumped this to the top of the list. Fellow beet lovers who responded to our Twitter call out, this is for you.
Today, we're using a lesser known beet, which is a golden beet. They are a little less earthy. A lot of people complain to me that they don't like beets because they taste like dirt. But I think that the golden beets are a little less that way. You can also get white beets and candy cane beets, which when you cut them, they'll be white and red on the inside. And those are really nice to use raw, sliced real, real thin over a salad. And they've got that kind of sweet, earthy flavor to them. The golden beets I do several different things with. These over here, this is the raw one, which you can see is very, very yellow. And then once you steam them, and we steam them for about 45 minutes. You'll see until you can stick a knife in it, and it pulls out easily. So if it has any resistance and the knife kind of tugs, the beet tugs at the knife, it's not ready. You really want to cook it till the knife slips out. There's several other different ways you can cook beets. You can roast them. We cook them here in our stone oven. We put a sheet tray with a bunch of kosher salt and then kind of rest those beets on top of the salt bed so they don't burn on the bottom. Kind of lifts them off the bottom of the oven. And then they roast. And that way they actually dehydrate a little bit and they get a very intense sweet flavor. Back in the old days, they would have the village bread oven heated up, and you'd cook your bread when the oven was hot, and then you would throw your other things like your beets and your pumpkins and your chickens in to catch the residual heat from the wood oven, so that all the villagers would bring their dishes down and cook them all in one oven. So I think that, you know, I mean, those are kind of nice old days, but I probably wouldn't want to have lived in them anyhow.
All right, there's our beet tutorial. Daniel has a recipe for us in a bit. Like all business owners, farmers want to get paid for their work. Sometimes that work creates problems for the environment. That's why regulators are advancing the idea of creating environmental markets to allow farmers to make money off their conservation practices. Harvest Public Media's Grant Gerlach has the story.
Leaves fall in green and yellow clumps in Lucas Lucky's soybean field near Columbus in northeast Nebraska.
If we could have just another week or 10 days of some warm and sunshine, we'd be ready to get picked.
Look at this 80-acre field and others like it in the Midwest, and you're seeing land shaped by markets.
20 acres of beans and then 60 acres of corn. The one corner we did take out of production and seeded that back to grass and take it as a hay crop.
Farmers like Lucky plant what they can sell, corn and beans for the grain market, hay for the cattle and the beef market. So what if you want farmers to plant cover crops to curb water pollution or to preserve habitat like the farm ponds on the other side of the field?
We see ducks and geese down there pretty much all year.
Why not just pay farmers to do that? Power plants in California are paying rice farmers to cut methane emissions for them. Farmers in Oregon are paid to plant trees to protect a salmon stream. Federal regulators, nonprofits, environmental groups, and state agencies are all studying whether it makes sense to create more markets for conservation.
So you have people saying to farmers, use cover crops, irrigate this way, and we'll pay you so many dollars per acre?
It's generally a little bit more complicated than that.
That's Jim Shortle, an economist at Penn State University who studies environmental incentives for farmers. He says these markets are about a couple things. First is to lower the cost of cutting pollution. Say your local utility needs to cut nitrates from a river. It could pay to expand a wastewater treatment plant, or it could spend less paying farmers to put in wetlands.
If you can get the ratepayers for the wastewater treatment plants to pay agriculture for the reductions, it makes it, in principle, easier to do.
Markets allow farmers to auction off conservation improvements to companies pushing pollution limits. And that makes sense because on issues like water quality, the EPA can't do much more through existing regulations.
And the reason why it can't is because agriculture is often the leading source of remaining pollution.
Farm fields aren't regulated like wastewater plants. Look at Iowa, where 92% of nitrogen pollution and 80% of phosphorus come from unchecked agricultural sources. Downstream, those nutrients can make drinking water unsafe and add to the dead zone in the Gulf of Mexico.
We cannot regulate our way out of our water quality challenges in this country.
Ann Mills of the U.S. Department of Agriculture says environmental markets could help get farmers engaged. USDA recently put $10 million behind grants to establish environmental markets, including one in Iowa to reduce nitrogen runoff.
We've got to get a lot more people involved, a lot more people. We have to scale this significantly.
But Scott Edwards of the environmental group Food and Water Watch says enrolling farmers in environmental markets avoids what he sees as the real issue.
We don't have the political will to force them to do what other industries do, which is mandatory monitoring and discharge permits.
Edwards says the USDA already subsidizes conservation measures and it hasn't corrected environmental problems. Meanwhile, federal crop insurance programs and ethanol requirements subsidize corn planting, which is a source of nitrogen pollution. But when it comes to regulating farms, Shortle, the Penn State economist, says we have to look at the reality.
You have to understand. So how many farmers do you have in Nebraska?
Oh, geez. Several thousand?
tens of thousands. So you just have to recognize that an agency looking at regulating all of them would be facing an enormous cost.
Congress won't foot that bill, so these markets are a potential solution. And that's not to say farmers are against conservation. Lucas Lucky tried cover crops, but they weren't worth the extra work. Now, if there was a market for it...
Farmers aren't dumb people. From a cost standpoint, we have a different soil. It might not work the best. But like you said, if $20 an acre to do it this way, the difference might be offset enough that that practice could work on this farm now.
Farmers like Lucky have their eye on the bottom line, and attaching a value to conservation could change how things add up. Grant Gerlach, Harvest Public Media.
Their website is harvestpublicmedia.org. Hope you'll check it out for more audio, print, and video stories from the agriculture scene around the country. This recipe, you guys, I am so eager to share it. It's pickled beets and some garlic and ginger and a cinnamon stick. No pressure canner necessary. Take it away, chef.
We're just going to make a vinegar and honey brine and pour it over the top and then just keep them in the fridge. So these won't be shelf stable. You'll have to refrigerate them. We're going to take the beet and we're going to dice it. You can cut it in any shape. You could leave them as kind of rectangles or fingers as well. That actually might be nice. I think that looks pretty like that. All right, so I'm going to grab a pot, and I'm going to show you how to make this vinegar bath. So I'm going to throw a couple of these Thai bird peppers in there. You could put a habanero in there or whatever you like. I'm going to add about a cup of water, a half cup of cider vinegar, honey. We've got about a quarter cup of honey, about a tablespoon of sugar. We're going to mash a couple cloves of garlic. Just throw in a couple more things. We've got an oregano sprig and a little bit of rosemary. I'm going to throw in a couple little baby sweet red peppers just for color.
Bring that to one boil.
I'm just going to pull out those little bird chilies, my cinnamon stick. Oh, that vinegar got me. Then we're going to pour this ginger vinegar over the top, fill it all the way up, and we seal it tight. And then what my grandma always did, she turned them over and left them on the counter like that to cool. And that's all she wrote.
Did you ever ask your grandmother why the heck she flipped it over like that?
It would hold the seal. And also the herbs and stuff would give their flavors and have it go up.
Smart lady.
Yeah.
We'll be sharing more listener-requested recipes over the next several weeks. If you have a veggie in your crisper that you have no idea how to prepare, check out eartheats.org for some inspiration. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Cardinal Spirits, a distillery making handcrafted spirits from regional ingredients in Bloomington, Indiana. More at cardinalspirits.com. And Charles Schwab and Company Incorporated, now with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media. Will Murphy, executive producer. It is always a pleasure to have you with us. Till next week, I'm Annie Corrigan.